wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake. This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in new basement studios by the lake, we've been off for a little while. I've been away.
Yeah, not that we deprived anybody of episodes. You put out the
annual best of, yes.
Which I listened to. Of course, as usual, you give me a hard time. Give me some stick, as they say, for not being there. But it was actually, I thought it was quite good. So if anybody is trying to catch up, I thought it was pretty good.
Did you listen to the mashup? Obviously, you listened to the mashup before the end, which is all the quick cuts. Did you notice in the very first of the quick cuts, that it's I think we were talking about desserts, and I actually say that I was committed to the European Union.
Yeah, I know. And of course, funny.
Ironically enough.
Apparently the rest of your fellow countrymen are not.
The rest of the country is not committed to the European Union. Yeah.
At least 50 and change percent of them aren't.
Well, I know this episode, we're actually going to talk about my trip to Europe, the Atlantic Voice Goes to Europe, where I went with some buddies on a sporting trip to Europe to see some different sports events. We will talk more about that. We have some sound effects. We will talk about the notion of watching these sort of events live, but I was actually home for Brexit.
Yeah, that's the first thing that happened kind of when you went there. I guess you go to the country and they decide they don't want to hang around anymore.
It's funny. I went to bed the night before the referendum kind of thinking that we were going to stay in. Because there'd been a couple of polls and someone on the Leave side had tweeted a message saying, oh, it looks like the Remain, which was the people who wanted to stay in Europe, have edged it. So I went to bed, even though I quite enjoy watching not so much politics on TV, but I kind of enjoy watching elections and watching this constant barrage of like vote counts coming in. It's a bit like watching the sports roundup. Like, now reporting in, so-and-so has won New Hampshire. And I find that, just as TV, I find it quite entertaining. So anyway, I was ready to stay up for a little while and watch the vote count come in from across Britain.
Yeah. By the way, we should mention it. I mean, I'm sure most people know already, but this is, the Brexit was the vote, you say, to leave Europe. Obviously, you can't Britain geographically yourself, although it is.
Although we're already detached.
But it's the European Union, which is an economic consortium of free trade and various things, but in exchange for which you have to abide by a bunch of rules of these folks in Brussels.
So anyway, I went to bed and it looked like Remain were going to win, but then the first score started coming in and it looked like we were going to leave. And because I felt like it was best for us to stay, I was like, oh, I'm not staying up for 3 hours watching this. So then I went to bed. I woke up again at like 6 a.m, quickly turned on my phone to see what happened. I saw that we were going to be leaving Europe, and I'm like, forget this. So I turned off my phone and went back to sleep. Woke up again 2 hours later, went into the front room, turned on the TV, right about the same time that the Prime Minister was announcing his resignation. So I've been back in England for about 14 hours. During that time, we've left Europe, and we suddenly have no Prime Minister. And I thought,
of course, he resigned because he had expected
he'd gone all in
to win, basically said we'd do this and we're going to stay, and once they didn't, had to step down.
So this is right at the start of my vacation. I remember waking up that I think I've been home now just one evening, and I'm thinking, oh wow, there's a lot going on here. And it was kind of interesting to be back in my home country during what will ultimately go down as an historic event, and I just found that kind of interesting.
Your timing couldn't have been better for interesting things to see what's going on.
Well, I know, I don't want to we don't do this sort of serious analysis on this, but I'm sure many of us remember where we were at certain times, like, oh, do you remember where you were on 9/11? Or people go, do you remember where they were when Kennedy was shot? Well, I'm going to remember where I was when Britain left the European Union and also had no Prime Minister all at the same time. Right. So it's all kind of strange. So that was...
I'm going to ask you, tell me what the impression was of people you were dealing with now, but it's worth noting, since you were in London, generally speaking, just the nuts and bolts of things, was London generally, and that the area there voted to stay.
Yes.
More rural areas.
And the industrial north.
Yep.
Voted to leave.
Meanwhile, Scotland,
voted
the extra rural north,
they voted to
stay because they see, I guess, better benefits being a...
Whereas Wales, which is...
They voted to leave.
And Northern Ireland voted to
stay.
Yeah. It's interesting. When you're in London, obviously, when you're in an area that overwhelmingly voted to remain, you were constantly in conversations with people who were like, yeah, I can't believe what we've just done.
Yeah.
The one thing I did find quite interesting from just randomly talking to people was even after the referendum, and apparently I think like 68 or 70% of the country that were eligible to vote actually went and voted, which I think at a certain level is actually quite impressive.
Sure.
What was interesting was talking to people who only figured out after exactly what their vote for Leave would actually mean.
Nah, I mean, that was the joke on all the stand-up comedians is like this. Google had disclosed that the number one search the day after this was what does it mean to leave
what
the EU
mean,
or like what is the EU? It was a bunch of things like that.
Yeah, I'm sure so,
could have been anybody sort of checking up on that. Did you run into anybody in London who said they had voted to leave?
I did.
And when they were they?
I wonder what it was interesting. I want to talk about a couple of different people. I want to give a shout out. I want to give a shout out to my sister, who is, you know, quite a lot younger than me. She is, you know, she's in her early.
She's not of indeterminate middle age.
She's not of indeterminate middle age. She is
early youth.
Yeah, she's basically she's just out of college, and so so she's quite politically aware. She's interested. I was really impressed hearing that she'd actually gone and voted, because there's always this sort of perception that young people don't vote.
Right.
She went and voted. I was really impressed. She was heavily committed to remaining.
And as most youth, that was the other way it broke down. Older people said.
And I was actually quite moved is the wrong word, and impressed is the wrong word. But she was really upset that she'd voted and come out on the losing side. And so I was glad to see that sort of passion. I did know, I did speak to a lot of people who voted to leave, and I did find that the stereotype that young people wanted to stay and old people wanted to leave, in just my very small anecdotal sliver, all the people that wanted to leave were much, much older. Much, much older. They might have lived through, they would have been kids maybe in the Second World War or at least in the 50s and 60s. And they're all like, yeah, well, it's a better thing and we're going to be fine. And it is, but it was interesting in London, which is obviously like any big city, it's multicultural. It's, you know, a lot of, it's very diverse, both in terms of the people that live there and where they've come from. The overwhelming feeling was, yeah, but we're leaving. What the heck are we doing? That the most depressing thing about it all was I'd come to Britain armed with pounds. I changed my money. I changed my money over to pounds.
I emailed you during that. Yeah. I thought like your trip had gotten cheaper and instead it had gotten more expensive.
No,
well, not expensive, but.
I always change money beforehand because I like to have cash. I show up within 48 hours, my value, my own personal value has increased by like 40%.
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
like,
so
oh,
the exchange rate changed. You know,
plummeted,
basically, people run out of pounds. So like the dollars got stronger against the pounds, meaning that your pounds are worth less dollars.
Yes. So the immediate concern for me for Brexit was I am now worth less when I'm over there. So, but it was interesting. It was interesting to be home in part of history. I must say, I was actually quite bothered by it all. I do. I tend to believe that you're better being in something than being out of something. But who knows?
Yeah, you know, well, in terms of the old, young, and parts of it, they said it has a lot to do with the industrial. It's the same things that where industrial areas, Rust Belt of America,
it's very
basically
similar.
Is concerned about trade, anything that would make free trade easier because they feel, and not inaccurate, that they end up with more jobs in other countries. Similar stuff here where the concern was, well, these open borders with places and cheap labor, it's, you know, you lose the industrial jobs there. But the other part, when you mentioned the older, younger in terms of wanting to be involved, I think, you know, think about it. If you were a Englishman, woman from who maybe you weren't alive in World War II, but you're alive in the aftermath of World War II at least, you would be much more accustomed culturally to the notion of England sort of standing alone and like having to deal with the stuff itself and would feel confident in that a good result can out from that. Whereas if you're a younger person, you'd be much more likely to be, hey, like you've come up in the internationalized, the financial center, all the benefits of London, how it's become such, I mean, not that it wasn't obviously a financial center before, but it's really become the financial center for Europe. And it's so international, much more free labor movement, a lot of immigration. Well, immigration is the wrong word in the England context, because in the EU,
you can
labor can just go
just
wherever
move around,
it wants. They aren't actually immigrating.
Yeah.
They're just coming to work. So you'd be much more accustomed to that. And so when people would say leave, you know, for you, it's a change. For older people, it's a return to something that had happened before.
When I go back to London, I'm a visitor. The person serving me my Starbucks is probably also a visitor. Yeah. It is interesting that I think your age does give you a point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's what you're accustomed to and what you're culturally comfortable with.
I do. The most fascinating thing about Brexit was when it was all done and dusted. And even now, this is nearly a month after now, people still don't actually know exactly what it means and what's going to happen next. And I do find that very different.
Well,
in the fact that we have an election coming here, for example, I know when people in this country run on something, the minute they've won,
you know, for example, if it's healthcare or whatever it is, they suddenly have an issue and, well, there you go, and they're going to get started with it. Brexit won the referendum, and people are still trying to figure out, well, what do we do next?
Well, right.
I did find that interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because so just not to get too much into the nitty-gritty of it, but it's a referendum. It wasn't literally a vote that causes the leaving. It was a referendum of the populace that said, we want to leave.
We want to leave.
And is, I think, technically not even really binding, but of course, obviously, to the extent the politics... So what has to happen next is the British government has to formally notify, which starts a two-year clock running for negotiating the exit and changes and replacements and new treaties and the like. So I'm not even sure that the referendum is actually binding, but obviously any government that basically that just ignored the fact that they called this referendum and said, we're going to do whatever the referendum says.
You're going to have a riot.
Have a trouble. Now, there was...
you're correct.
It's I originally not. Saw something about the article and paper talking about how somebody had commented, and this is before... I mean, you what's her name? Theresa May is now going to be
the Prime Minister.
Not officially,
yes.
Formally done, but she's now...
No, she went to see the Queen.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Once you see the Queen,
so they had all the votes.
Yeah,
right. Because they're not calling a new election of Parliament.
No,
so it's the same people are in power. So it becomes the Conservative Party.
It is very similar to turning over your Speaker of the House.
Right.
It's an internal thing.
Yep.
Joe Citizen doesn't get to say who the leader of the House or the leader of the Senate is. It's very similar. It just happens to be that person has, you know, is kind of the president,
yeah,
to put everything.
But how we got there was really interesting. So somebody had comment. It was actually apparently this was somebody was citing a comment on a newspaper article and saying, you know, this is the thing. Nobody's going to want to give that notice, and people are going to. It may never get given because nobody wants to be the one to give the notice.
It's going
to so
get given.
If you can, I think that is the case now. But if you could string it out long enough, in theory, people might change their mind. I mean, like, there was a lot of people changing their mind 2 days after this.
Yes.
Whoa, I didn't realize this is going to happen this way. And, you know, who's to say if you string it out long enough and people won't say, well, let's just have another referendum,
yeah,
and say no. But Boris Johnson, who was he doing anything? He was mayor of London at some point, but he's not mayor of London now.
No, he is now foreign secretary.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
yes.
So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting parts. So he was expected to be one of the leading candidates for prime minister.
Yeah.
Because even though he was on the conservative side, he was part of the Leave group. But then his chief advisor basically jumped over him and put his name into the ring.
There was a lot of backstabbing.
Yeah, and then Boris Johnson says, never mind. And I'm sure he was like, well, I don't want to go down in history, this person who had this. And meanwhile, the other guy, the other agitator, I forget his name.
Gove. Yeah.
Like, he was like backtracking off of a bunch of things. And then the guy who was the advisor, I don't know how he decided not to run. But now it was suddenly down to like these two women, one who was
Remain. And she'd always had her hat in the ring.
Right.
And then another lady who'd only been in Parliament since the last election,
right,
was suddenly thrust into...
Yeah, the Remain one was
May,
like some sort of administrator.
She was Home Secretary.
Undersecretary?
Home Secretary, which I guess is our equivalent of, here in America, I don't know what the direct equivalent of...
It's
a much more important position than
it's a weird mix. It doesn't quite line up with our departments, but it's immigration, border security, policing, things like that. But not like the head of
it's
justice.
Not justice,
right,
no.
Right.
But it is important in the way that justice is important. In fact, may even be more important.
So they fall all over each other, and you know, and look where we, like, basically everybody's been falling. And then even on the other side, the guy who's like the Bernie Sanders of the Labor Party, now everybody's all pissed at him and they're trying to get rid of him. And I read an article today talking about, they're calling it the glass cliff, which is apparently, people have done studies of this, that whenever institutions and governments and things like that are in their worst crises, you're more likely to have women leaders. Like, women leaders get installed to deal with it.
Oh,
and
really?
The theory is that men have more options, and whenever this stuff gets to this point, they go, well, I'm done. I can go move on to something else. And whereas women will more – so, like, they cited the woman who – I forget her name – who leads Yahoo.
Yeah.
She came in to save Yahoo. What's his name? Carly Fiorina came into HP when it was in, like, horrible straits, and arguably she might have left it in worse straits. But it was a lot of this – saying, look at who's – we end up where basically the only people left standing are the women because all the men were like, never mind.
Well, there was that – you know, I kind of felt – not felt sorry is the wrong word. But, you know, David Cameron lost the referendum in that his idea was defeated. But it was not a referendum on his ability to do the job. He decided – I don't want any part of this. He actually didn't have to resign.
No.
And that's the interesting thing. I think a lot of people who don't really understand it woke up that morning and said, well, he lost, so I guess he's out. But he didn't. He just decided, yep, I got beat. I'm out of here. Yeah. This is someone else's problem.
He doesn't want to be the one backing this. So, and the thing that you alluded to in that was that then May makes Boris Johnson the foreign ambassador or whatever.
Foreign secretary, which is sort of like Secretary of State, but not quite. It's not quite as influential as our Secretary of State here in America, who's always seen to be a very powerful and influential position.
So meanwhile, he's been insulting all the foreign leaders for life. So immediately they all put the boot on it. And like, and a bunch of things said, like, this was a way to marginalize him, like to basically put him off to somewhere.
Well, I actually think that's a true statement, because Brexit, under normal circumstances, the process of Brexit would be handled by the Prime Minister's office and the Foreign Secretary. But because the Prime Minister is creating a special department to handle Brexit, he's going to be left touring around nations and doing whatever the Foreign Secretary does, which, unlike the Secretary of State, isn't really that important.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a really interesting time to be back. And I must say, there was a part of me who was like, ooh, well, this has got my vacation off to a cracking start. So,
and got our podcast off to a cracking start. Yes. But enough politics. Yeah. From here on out, it's pretty much all sports, I think.
Yes.
Well, no, we do have another historical event along the way. But your next step, did people go to Wimbledon while you were there? Or did you go to Wimbledon?
I didn't go to Wimbledon. There were three of us. I'd obtained two tickets for Wimbledon on the opening Monday of the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So the ticket.
Is this like a 1 versus 122 seed kind of thing?
Well, no. What happens at Wimbledon is when you get your tickets, two tickets for court one, which is not center court. Right. It's the next biggest court. And basically, you have those seats all day. It's not like you have the 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock session. Right. You have seats all day.
But it's only going to be two or three matches, right?
No, the first matches are at 11 and they keep going till 8 in the evening because it's light.
Yeah, but matches are like, aren't they like 3 hours? I don't even know.
I think you're right. When it's one versus, when it's number one versus number 120, the matches are not 3 hours.
Yeah, right. I can be a little faster.
They're burning through a whole load of matches that first day. Anyway, so that were tickets for two of us. And, I kind of let my two buddies go because they were tennis fans. And I'm not particularly a tennis fan. But the original plan was, you can get in on the day. You can shop and get what's called a grounds ticket, which allows you to roam around all the outer courts. In doing my research, I discovered that at Wimbledon, if you want to queue up and get in on the day, you have to get there at like 2 o'clock in the morning the night before to get in something that the Wimbledon website calls the queue. It's basically the official
get in line.
And remember how you did the boosting theme where you were given a wristband? Yep. Same principle. The only thing is that if you really want to get in, you need to be there at 2 in the morning. And I sat there and I'm like, I don't need to see Wimbledon that bad enough. Well, I'm like, why don't you guys go to Wimbledon? And they had a great time. They came back to me that night and they kept saying, oh, you need to go.
What's the, like, is it in the traditional dish, like strawberries?
Strawberries and cream. Yeah. And I told them, have the strawberries and cream. And when they came back, I was like, did you have strawberries and cream? And it was met with a, yeah. They kept saying to me, oh, it's great, you need to go. And I'm like, yeah, one day, but not tomorrow.
Your other two people, I know one of them was from here. Is the other one from here?
From America.
The States, yeah.
Yeah, they were both American and they were both big tennis fans.
So big deal for them.
Yeah, it was good for them. And for me, I just turned on the TV and watched it on TV. Mm-hmm. More than enough for me. Mm-hmm. And again, it's funny because I do want to, I know as we talk about some of the other things we did, I'm going to circle back to the notion of watching sports on TV and watching it live.
But
again, if I could have just, I would have gone if A, I'd had a ticket, or B, just show up and get in. But getting up there the night before, and because on TV they always show this massive field where everyone is pitched tents, and these are the regular people who are trying to get in on the day. And I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, yeah, forget that.
I don't want to be that bad.
I don't need it that badly, yeah.
I was thinking about it. When you go to a tennis match, you want tickets on the side, right?
No, I think you want tickets at the end. If you're on the side, you got to keep moving your head.
Well, that's what I'm just thinking about, because the fact that TV, because when you mentioned the TV, I thought to myself, it's TV's the only sport that's shot from the end.
Yes.
Whereas all the other sports are shot
from the side,
sideline.
They had tickets in sort of the corner.
I guess if the TV was swinging back and forth, you'd get
like motion sickness. Yeah, yeah. The tickets they had were in the corner. They said it was really good. You can, you really got a sense of how hard the men serve the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, yeah, that's because they flash it up on the scoreboard. Yeah. If you watch tennis, it comes on and says, oh, he just hit it 130 miles an hour. But no, all jokes aside, they said it was great. And apparently it is one of those things you need to go. But you, as an individual, need to decide.
So you're going
to
wait till some other occasion when you actually have a seat to an actual... Don't go on day one where you got to wait in line. Just go to one where you know where you're going to be sitting.
Well, because I'm not a tennis fan. I'm not knocking it as an experience. I'm not a tennis fan. But that said, you know, it did make me think, is there any sporting event that I would be that pressed to get into? And I just think me as a person...
You mean to go at 2 a.m. and to...
Yeah.
Particularly if it's still just opening round. It's not, none of those matches are going to be a big deal if you luck into one of those eternity ones.
But I'll be honest with you, I don't think there's anything where I would be queuing up overnight to get a ticket. I'm not that type of guy. Not nowadays when I can watch it on telly.
Well, I mean, like, listen, if you were for Arsenal's playing in the Champions League final, and, you know, that's what I mean. If it's a really big game, you would do that.
Maybe. I mean, I'm naturally quite a lazy person. And if my option is watching it on TV or spending the night in a field in the tent, forget that.
All right, then. So that was it for Wimbledon?
That was Wimbledon, yeah.
And then next?
Then next we went to France, because the idea of going to France for 5 days was to go and see the start of the Tour de France.
Uh-huh.
And the Tour de France this year started in Normandy, started at the ancient Abbey Mont-Saint-Michel, which, if you've seen the pictures, I'll probably post them on the blog.
Mm-hmm.
It is like a large abbey / ancient village / castle that sits out in a bay off Normandy, and at certain times the tide completely surrounds it, so it looks like an island.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean facetious when I say this. If you don't know what I'm talking about, if you've ever seen The Wonderful World of Disney and the Disney castle comes up, that's what it looks like. And I don't mean that facetiously.
It's a very classic
spires. It's huge, and it was easily one of the most impressive things I've seen. And the topography of Normandy is sort of like rolling hills. It's all agricultural farmland. There's sheep and cows everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It is the part of France where they just grow stuff. There's one port city, and then the rest of it are these small French towns that, if you have a cliched idea of France, that's what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
When you drive to Mont-Saint-Michel, you actually come over the edge of the hills, and you can see for like 30 kilometers out into the bay. And from, you know, 30 miles away, you can see this thing sitting out in the bay, and it really is a very impressive sight. And I understand why the tour started there.
So is it an island or not an island?
It is an island, yes. Okay. It's basically a rock.
So how did you take a boat there? Or?
No, what happens is that and someone explained it to me. The tide comes in every day. And
Twice a day.
And
That's just a global thing. Okay. I don't really know Normandy's tides, but I'm pretty sure tides go twice a day everywhere.
The regular tides that come in once or... Don't get hung up on this. The daily tides come in and surround 75% of it. So there is a causeway that you can continually walk across to get to it. Then I think like once a month when you have like a new moon and this type of thing, the tide comes in to the extent that it becomes a true island. So most of the time, it actually is accessible by this causeway. You can walk it. There's a shuttle bus. It's about 2,000 meters, and I'm now talking in meters and kilometers because I was just in Europe. It's about a 35-minute walk from sort of the hard coast, meaning the part of the coast that is truly land and never floods unless there is a flood, if I'm making sense there. So like I say, on a daily basis, you can walk out to it. You can actually walk out into the bay. But when we got there, we walked all the way around the base of Mont-Saint-Michel, which took about 45 minutes. And then we went up onto the island and into the old town and up into the abbey, which the whole thing is about 50 floors high from the base of the bay. By the time we were up in the abbey about 2 hours later, where we'd been walking on the ocean side of Mont Saint Michel was now underwater. But the causeway...
Is it all like sand, or do they have like... Was it paved and then it floods, or...?
No, the causeway is paved, but all around sort of most of the exterior, it's just the floor of the bay. Mm-hmm. Like you're sort of walking in like hard-packed sand. It's like walking on the beach. And it's just, again, it's a really interesting place. It's quite... Obviously, like so many things in Europe, it's old. And I don't mean that facetiously. If you're in Europe and a lot of the planet... These structures are anything from 800 to thousands of years old. But it's very impressive, very big.
Apparently, yeah. By the way, tides are sometimes two times a day. Sometimes different areas, I guess, have different patterns of tides. I'm accustomed to two times a day, I'm pretty sure.
But I think if you again, I'll post some photos on the blog. But if you ever sort of Google Mont Saint-Michel, the stereotypical picture, let me say, is always of it being completely surrounded by water, because that's what makes it amazing.
It's a better photo up.
But I must say, it is one of those places that once you go to it, it's even more amazing in real life.
Hmm.
And
a lot of times I find almost the
opposite.
Because people who can take a good picture can make something look like amazing, and you get there and you go, well, yeah, it doesn't quite look like that perfect picture.
Well, I don't want to speak to that for a moment. I'm not a photographer. So I whip out my iPhone and I'm just clipping away. But even in some of my pictures, I'm like, wow, yeah, it's impressive. So anyway, we went there to scout out the start of the Tour de France. And then we went back across Normandy to where we were staying, because the next day, this is a couple of days in advance of the Tour de France, the next day we went to tour the Normandy beaches.
Yeah, like meaning, so for those
Omaha,
of us who don't know, this is the big assault on D-Day.
Yeah, Saving Private
World
Ryan.
World War II. Yeah, that's right.
That's the movie.
So, you know, this is the assault on the beaches, and there was this whole bit about, like, where there was a fake that there was going to be an assault in a different area,
and then,
you know, everybody comes in shore. We're talking about the full Allied forces, I think principally British and
British, American, Canadian,
but other countries, too. I pulled up a couple of pieces of information about D-Day.
Okay.
Why was it called D-Day?
I don't know.
The D stands for day.
So it was day.
Like, basically, when you were leading up to an invasion or something like that, or a big event, you'd be D minus whatever.
Okay.
And then it's D plus, like, when you're scheduling it out.
Oh, I didn't know.
So, like,
that.
The D day is the center
the day. Yeah, all right.
And it's everything else
all
before
right.
and after.
Because it's D. Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, D day. All right, so there you go.
As not to be confused with VE or VJ days, which were victory in Europe, victory in Japan.
It's actually called Operation Overlord.
Yeah, there was a number of operational names, and I couldn't quite sort out which was what.
Well, it's officially Overlord, because apparently Winston Churchill was impassioned that because he knew it was going to be a big moment in the war, he wanted everyone, Eisenhower, Montgomery, whoever, he wanted to make sure that it had a foreboding and strong name.
Hmm.
Didn't want it to be called Operation Dining Table or Operation Green, which is what normally happens.
Yeah.
I mean, but he wanted Operation Overlord, which does sound, you know, impending doom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there you go.
So 156,000 troops landed at Normandy on that day, I think. About American were 73,000. British and Canadian, I guess, we're lumped together.
Probably. But yeah, the British and the Canadian. Yeah, what happened was that there were like four main landing points. I think Juneau, Sword, Omaha, and Utah.
Mm-hmm.
The American, the American whatever army, you know, the 4th Infantry or whatever, they were assigned to Omaha and Utah, and the Brits and the Canadians had Juneau and Sword, which were about 25 miles further south.
Oh, is that right? That
yeah.
Far. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite, you know, Normandy is basically, you know, if you can imagine a picture of France, France looks kind of square. It's in the upper left-hand corner. A little bit sticks out. That's Normandy. And it's about, you know, about 60 miles long from the main, sort of from the bulk of France to the tip of Normandy. And basically, you know, The D-Day landings took place in like a 30-mile stretch of Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like 4.5. It was basically an overnight trip from England in boats back then. It is the most surreal thing to go and stand on the beach at Omaha. And again, this is now just a very small French seaside town. There's just like a row of houses, people, beachfront property. There's always museums all over, and then there'll be like a tank sitting on a concrete square or something to sort of, you know, just
not
as
live.
No, not live, obviously, no.
Not like a Turkish tank.
But the only sort of official monument is a very understated sort of, I can't remember what it was. It was sort of like a stone, sort of like an obelisk type thing, and a couple of flagpoles. And then there's some plaques that say, you know, this is Omaha Beach. I actually went down and walked along Omaha Beach for about, you know, for about a mile, three quarter of a mile. And there are, you know, little kids making sandcastles and people out walking their dog. And it's, you know, it's the beach.
It's a nice beach that way, recreationally. Was it a nice
beach? Actually is. I mean, it's quite sandy. And I can imagine, I think that's why they picked it. It was obviously flat, but it's quite deep,
right.
So you can get your boats in there. Like, there's not rocks and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It is beach, so it's the perfect place to land and get off and try and get a whole load of troops up. But it is a bit odd to stand there
And I think anyone who's ever been to Gettysburg or any kind of, you know, the Somme or any kind of historical site, you can't help but stand there and sort of think, oh, wow, yeah, who knows what was happening right where I was standing.
Yeah.
And I did try and take some, I did try to do a little spiel for the show with my recorder.
That's
so
right.
Why don't you play that? We're not going to play much of it because as we'll find out.
That sounds like the Normandy winds.
Yes, this is what it, and of course now, I need to be very upfront. For anyone who listens to the show who is like a tech geek, yes, I'd forgotten the little thing to put on my microphone.
The little foam thing.
The little foam thing.
Yeah,
so there you go.
Like
there's me. So I want you
that's
to
pretty much it's so really you can get rid of that here now.
For any of you who wanted proof that I was on holiday in Europe, there's your proof. I was right there on the beach trying to do something for the Atlantic Voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it is amazing. Now, I was over there. It was the start of July. So in a strange way, we are 62 years to the, to the day. Europe, you know, I think when you say beach to people, people think, oh, sunny, yeah, 80 mm-hmm. degrees. Northern France is cold and windy, and it's about, you know, anything from 55 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And here's the trouble. When you go back to Europe, everything's in centigrade. I have no idea. When you're looking at
when
your
you
phone,
say kids
it's
were
like,
playing, were people swimming? Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No one was in the water.
So
even,
we're dealing with
even the dog that was fetching a ball, he didn't look like he fancied it.
Because I'm thinking about this time of year in America, because I was about to compare it to, like, say, being up on Cape Cod or something like that. But even at this time of year, people be swimming in Cape Cod.
There was no one swimming. It was cold. And I'm thinking, wow, this must have been pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And you're getting off in the water and it's cold and you're soaking wet and you're carrying all that
and
stuff
getting
shot at and things are blowing up. And
the one interesting, when I was looking at the stats, right? So I said 150, whatever change, 1,000 people were on there. And you get a picture from seeing the movies or things like that.
Yeah.
That you almost, if somebody had told you like half of the people were killed, you might be like, okay, you know, there's piles of dead bodies. But
yeah.
The total casualties, although there's definitely been like revisions, it's something like at some point it was thought to be about 2,500, and now it's more like 5,000. People think the numbers are bigger, and by casualties, I should say killed. Casualties,
it's still
wounded also, but I'm counting
it's
killed.
It's still less than the number of people that they put ashore.
Way less, and percentage-wise, like so it's obviously a huge loss of life, and you can understand why tons of people know about it, but it's not as if when you got off that boat, you had a 50-50 chance. You know, it was a
to 1 in
95% of people. No,
yeah.
I mean, like 5,000, 150,000, you know, it's a...
Because when I did that little report that we cut short because of the wind,
yeah.
I actually think I remember I said, yeah, I'm standing where 100,000 people were killed, mainly because I'd seen the movie and I figured, that's what it looked like. No, and I know, we're being very blasé and throwaway about something and we don't mean to be, but it's interesting. It's actually quite moving to stand there and sort of know, wow, this is what happened. But like I say, for me, the most amazing thing is to go there now, and this is just towns.
Yeah,
because I think
they're going to do stop and make everything a permanent museum.
No, and that's my point. And yet, in a strange way, you think you should, but it's not. It's what it is. So that was D-Day.
All right, and then like the troops, you make your way inland at that point.
We make our way back inland. We were, and then the next morning was the Saturday, and we headed off to see the start of the Tour de France,
like the very start.
The
so this
very
is the first
start.
Date. Were you
this
at the start?
We were at the start, and we've got some clips we're going to play in a moment.
How many people?
I do not know. Everyone in France. The start is it's called Le Grand Départ. So it's a big festival because they're introducing the teams for the first time.
Like a Royale with cheese?
It is. It's a Royale with extra cheese. Here's the amazing thing about the Tour de France. And I'm a cyclist and I'm a cycling fan. And so I watch the Tour every year. I watch quite a lot of cycling on TV. I follow it in the newspaper. But from a neutral perspective, I think all of us have this image of the Tour de France. We all sort of understand... I think most of us understand the enormity of it as an athletic endeavor. These guys are going to ride 3,000 miles in 3 weeks or something
like that. Or run, as we'll discuss
in a second. Yeah. And we all know that for France, it's a big part of sort of French identity. It's a way they showcase themselves to the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you go to the Tour de France that you realize the internal cultural impact that it has. It is this massive event that means something to the French people.
And as I'm going to explain, we basically went to the grand start of the Tour de France.
Is that what this clip is? Should I play this?
No, I'm going to ask you to play something in a minute called Caravan.
Okay.
And I'm going to get to that. But the Tour de France...
So, like, let me ask this. So, but this is more about the crowd there. Are we talking about there's 150,000 people there?
I wouldn't like to say, because you're in a small village. But when you stand by the side of the road, the crowd goes 8 or 9, 10 deep on both sides.
For 10 miles or for?
Well, this was all through this small town around Mont-Saint-Michel, because everyone had descended upon it because everyone wants to say, I saw the very start. So you, but here's the interesting thing about it as a sporting event. When you go and stand there, when you go to a game in the arena, there's an announcer telling you what's happening, and there's a clock and a scoreboard. When you go to Tour de France, any information to do with the actual athletic event, you've had to glean from the paper. Oh, they will be rolling out at 12 o'clock. But beyond that, there's no one here going, here they come.
What about a radio station or something?
Oh, it's in French. I can't understand that.
Well, listen, we're going to talk about some car racing. I don't know if you're doing this, but at NASCAR, they have like a local radio station. You put on some headphones. I would think for the Tour, they could easily
have. You could do that,
could put on.
But what I'm saying, because you're not in an arena, that's down to you to figure that out yourself. Yeah. It's not like you walk through the gate and it says here, get your race radio. Yeah, so you're there. I kind of figured out that the race was about to start. They had sort of the French equivalent of the Blue Angels and the Red Arrows, like a fighter display group. They came flying over the bay, and I actually caught a picture of the over Mont Saint-Michel and spraying the tricolor out the back. And so you kind of know, ooh, the race is coming. Here's the interesting thing about the Tour de France, and we're going to play a clip in a little while. I understand it's 200 people on their bikes, and when you watch on TV, you're watching guys on their bikes. But people don't realize that the Tour de France is also about, just in this one little convoy, it's about 50 cars and about 50 motorbikes and 4 helicopters going overhead. Mm-hmm. And so you know the Tour is coming when you can hear the clack, clack, clack of helicopters and there are cars racing by and there are motorbikes honking their horns. You suddenly realize, oh yes, there is a bike race that's going to roll by in a couple of minutes. It's only when you go to the Tour that you realize it's this massive thing, convoy, that takes over the French roads for 21 days. So anyway, I want to play something in a moment here. I want to set this up a minute. Obviously, if you stand by the side of the road and watch a bike race go by, your athletic experience is about 7 seconds. Yeah. I'm going to say this right now as a cycling fan.
No, we saw the cycling in the Olympics, and obviously it was a much smaller event, but it was similar in like it's like.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I don't like tennis. Cycling sucks. If you go and watch it in the flesh, there they are. There they go. That's it. I mean, there's nothing to it. So what they do in France is, obviously the Tour de France is a big commercial thing. It's all got all kinds of sponsors and everything. An hour and a half before the Tour comes by your town, your town is on the route, there's something in front called the Sponsors Caravan. And it is a mile-long parade of floats from supermarkets and Bic Pens.
Floats?
Float, like truck floats, like the Rose Bowl Parade.
Yeah.
And these things come rolling by, and every time they get to a town, they are throwing out candy and whatever their product is. I caught a hat from some French delicatessen. My buddies caught a reusable shopping bag from McCain Frozen Foods. I was also hit by a Bic pen that was thrown at me. It was a yellow pen, and it says Tour de France on it, so I brought that home. So you stand by the side of the road, and this, I guess it must be like a mile-long parade of sponsors' wagons comes by with, you know, kids and students on it throwing stuff. It's each one is blaring music. There are guys in mascot costumes. Can you play what it says here? That I think it says Tour Caravan.
That's Depart Caravan. The first one.
Yeah, Caravan. Play that one.
This one?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a time frame you want to?
Just let it play. So just let this play and I talk. You're standing by the side of the road, and this is what it sounds like for about 25 minutes. And this is, all you're hearing is each truck going by, each one is blaring music, those people cheering.
Were they blaring the same? Because I don't feel like the songs are changing.
Well, no, because it's all moving quite slowly. All these people.
It'd be better if it was running at the full Tour de France speed.
All these people yelling. You're yelling because you want someone to throw you something.
Yeah. There'll be some beads.
I was
again, I was like four deep by the side, and there are people pushing past me whenever these little packets of sweets are hitting the ground. Even I'm losing. I've got my hands up like, yeah, throw me something, throw me something. So what I'm saying is, in France, the sponsor's caravan rolls by.
More wind.
More wind, yeah. That's what happens when you forget your furry thing, and I don't mean anything by that. The sponsor's caravan rolls by, and this was right at the start. But if you're in some town in France, this thing comes about an hour and a half beforehand. Yeah. So you come and hit the streets, this mile-long parade of mascots and trucks.
So it doesn't run the full course, obviously.
Oh, it does. It runs in front of the race.
Yeah, but if it's going this slow, they get caught.
Well, no, but when they're not in towns, they speed up.
Okay.
But anytime there's groups of people, the caravan slows down, and it's just throwing stuff out. So that's the sponsor's caravan. It's hard to explain, you know. I guess the American equivalent would be, yeah, there's Ronald McDonald standing on the back of a big truck waving, and someone's throwing out hamburgers and this kind of thing. This goes on for like 25 minutes.
Yeah, but it can't be like the Thanksgiving Day parade with, like, because if it had to speed up between the towns, the big ship or whatever the heck thing, people fall off.
It's not a parade in that sense, but what it is it's a caravan of vehicles that are throwing out goodies. And so I think if you're in some small French town, that rolls through, and then you now know I'm going to hang out at the side of the road drinking and hanging out with my buddies, and then in about an hour, the tour is going to come through. So I want you to play, I think it says TDF Chef DuPont. And just let this play, and I'm going to set this up. This is what I'm going to let this play, and it's not going to – you can actually – if you can –
it's pretty long.
Yeah, can you scroll forward to about 1 minute and then just let it play, and I'm going to talk and set it up.
Yeah, I'm just holding it down here. So we're about 50 seconds. So
this is a place called Chef DuPont. And I'm standing by the side of the road, and these are the first motorbikes rolling by this small town. So now this is the race coming, and this is what the Tour de France sounds like if you're in some small French town that you might see on TV with all the people hanging out there.
Mm-hmm. How many people are around you at this? Because they don't sound like a very loud crowd.
No, because it's a very small village. It was like about 14 houses, and it was like one left turn, and that was it. And this is just the crowd. They're cheering the first riders rolling through. If you listen closely,
early in the race, or
this was towards the end of the first day. Yeah, you can hear the helicopters ahead. So when you hear the helicopter, you know that the big race is coming. Like what they're called.
I meant really in the stage. Are we at the front of this? Are we at the tail end of the stage?
This is about an hour from the finish.
Okay, so nobody's big push on just yet.
No, but they're racing for real. Yeah, whereas when you're at the grand start, everyone's just rolling around. Yeah.
You're doing the bit where you like run around the side with your little devil costume or whatever it is.
Now you hear that sort of whing, whizzing.
Yeah, it's bikes, isn't it?
That's the bikes going by and them changing gears. They have all these electronic gears now. You just hear that? That's them actually changing gears. So that I'm going to now give you a sense, because I actually you can turn that down, but let it roll. You can hear the cars and the helicopters. In cycling, the bulk of the field are called the peloton. Yeah. That's where most guys are riding along. From the start...
French for bulk of the field.
There you go, yeah. from the start of the peloton to the very last vehicle, it takes nearly 5 minutes for this convoy of vehicles going about 20 to 25 miles an hour go by.
How many cyclists are there?
The peloton, there's 180 cyclists that start the race, so the peloton normally has about 175 of them.
Yeah.
So all those cyclists and about 40 cars and motorbikes and helicopters takes 4 minutes to go by. And then here's the interesting thing. The very last vehicle that comes through is a police car, and it has a sign on it that says back of the race. And once that rolls by, people just walk back out into the street again because the tour is gone.
Well, as long as you're parts that don't have barriers. They have the barriers towards the end, right?
Towards the end, yeah. But if you're in some little French town and the tour is rolling by, when that rolls through, that's it. Race done. And people walk back into the street.
Time to go get a baguette.
Well, no, we knew, and we saw the start. Then we jumped back into our hire car, and we're like, we're going to see the race. We're going to see
the race. Hire car being a rental right car, not like you don't have a driver.
We're gonna see the tour at two other stops today. So we got out our GPS.
Does everybody
maps.
Do the same thing?
All I know is, in this part of France, the roads are about the country roads. They're about 8 foot wide.
Yeah.
there are all kinds of cars zooming in every direction.
Sure, if everybody's trying to go to the same next spot.
Well, I don't think everyone's going to the same next spot, but everyone's going to another spot, and you are just bombing around the French countryside, trying to keep an eye on where the helicopters are. You're looking at a map. You're just driving in all kinds of directions. We stopped at two other towns in the course of the next 5 hours and saw the race twice. Again, in terms of a sporting spectacle, yeah, it sucks. You're standing there and a bunch of cyclists go by. But at each
in terms of activity you're participating in, that's part of it. Like mountain bike race type stuff. It's much more of like a festival feel than in a sporting event feel.
That's what it is. And you have to. And here's the interesting thing.
I didn't hear anything interesting.
No, this is just the end of it.
Well, I want to hear if they say something like, "This is the end of the race."
No.
Just the same French, so I wouldn't recognize.
No. The police car rolls through. Mm-hmm. If you're standing out in the street, it might do that. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And then it goes through and it just says end. And the police car says, I think it says, I can't remember what it says, but it means back of the race.
All right.
And once that rolls through, that's it. And everyone just walks back. It's like one of those movies where everyone walks back out into the street and goes back about their business. We knew that the tour was coming. That was the last village that we got to. Again, it was about 45 minutes from the finish of the race. So we end up in this French town and we're standing there on the pavement. And again, it's some tiny town. So it is a mix of people like us and basically the people that live there. We knew the race was coming, obviously because of the noise that comes towards you, but also everyone who was in the local pub behind us came out onto the street. They've been watching it on TV. They all come out on the street with their glasses of beer. They watch the tour go by. They're yelling and cheering. Everyone's wearing their freebie hat that they've been thrown. It's this interesting cultural experience. Now, if you want to know what's going on, watch on television. I didn't know who won the race until we got back to our house and turned on the TV and on French TV.
Even watching on TV, it's hard to know who next won.
Yeah. You don't know what's going on. Obviously, I think if you speak French, you can have the radio on. You don't know. When you stand there and watch the race go by, if you don't speak French or if you don't have a radio, you have no idea. I think that was so-and-so. Oh, that might have been such. Oh, I think that dude is hurt. You have no idea what's going on. But you are engulfed by this sort of cultural and commercial energy and excitement. And I can understand, we stopped at two little French towns. You get the feeling that people are hanging out at their second floor window to watch the race go by. It's kind of cool. It's an interesting, like I said, it's an interesting cultural experience. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. I have two tour-related questions,
hit me.
Events that happened, and then we can talk about the state of the tour, but at least in America. I think I'm going to do in reverse order. You know, you mentioned the motorbikes.
Yeah.
They had the crash a couple of days ago where, again, this is happening every year now. They ran into the back of a motorbike.
It always happens on the mountains.
Was it Froome who lost his bike?
Froome lost his bike and then started running.
Right? Because in theory, so his support team is supposed to be bringing him a bike.
Yeah.
But apparently this is against the rules. Like, you're supposed to stay put when you get a bike.
They basically,
when it was all over, they said that was fine because the problem was people. Like, people were all over him. Like, I saw this picture. It's literally like he was like a hunted man. He's running down the road. There's a crowd around him and he's like looking behind him as if he's being chased by a murderer or something like that.
On my bucket list now, being a cycling fan, I've seen the start of the Tour de France on the flat. I've been in villages. I get a sense of what it is. On my bucket list now is to go back one day and go up a mountain.
Go up to one of these climbs where everybody's
100,000 people have gone. They've been drinking all day and they're standing in the road and it's a melee.
Yeah.
I think that is sort of what I saw. That's that multiplied by 10.
You better hurry up and do that because I have a feeling after these past couple of years, they're going to start cordoning off more. I'm sure they are already. They haven't closed it all off, obviously, but I bet you every year it's a little bit more. I noticed, you know, didn't they have the crash along that tree lined road a couple of years ago? I noticed when that was on TV, it seemed to have barriers everywhere now.
There are more barriers popping up, but I think, you know, I guess the barrier companies are going to be more than happy to get into business because they're going to have to barrier a 6-kilometer stretch of mountainside. I don't know. I think that's part of it.
That could be part of the festivals. You gather up all the barriers and you bring them further down.
But anyway, he was running after his bike, and I'm going to tell you something. There's nothing more hilarious than watching a pro cyclist run.
People who don't know the shoes, those bike shoes are like, it's like wearing like
slippery skates.
Yeah, like they're hard plastic on the bottom. You can't run on anything with those. And then the other crash that happened, which like I'd heard about and then I saw the video, which was the inflatable thing falling down.
Yes.
Which was like, so these inflatables, it's not just like a set of balloons you'd have at a wedding. It's this like X that goes across and they're big tubes.
Big inflatable arch, basically.
So I'd heard that this thing had fallen down and somebody crashed into it. And I said, oh, well, I guess it's sort of surprising. It might have deflated and fell down. But I watched the video, and it literally drops like a stone. Have you seen the video?
Yeah, sabotage.
I don't care what anyone says.
That was
it
sabotage.
Literally drops like it's sitting there. He must be 20 yards away, and it immediately goes right down in front of him, and he crashes straight into it. That's so weird. Did anybody ever find out what had happened?
No, it just goes into tour legend. It is. It's interesting. It's not like a normal sport. There are rules of the road, but there's no rule book.
You know what it is?
Yeah.
It's French,
yeah.
Like, it's a huge rule book, but it's not all really rules.
It's
all, like, negotiable. Like, the whole thing with the run, you weren't supposed to run. And I think even with the inflatable, didn't they, like, create some dispensation for him afterwards or something?
It's French, and it's the way we do it.
Yeah.
But I would recommend going to see the tour. And again, I was excited to be at the start. It was in one of the most historic places in France. Again, you're not watching sport. You're experiencing an event.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think it's an important
very
thing.
Very festival-like. And if you're running around and, like I said, baguettes, cheese, salami.
But I'm not joking. I was more than happy when we got back to France to sit and watch it on TV, because then I actually know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go.
So next, from there, you head back to London. I don't think there's anything to tell before your next sporting event.
No.
All right. So actually, perfect segue, because the TV. So the next thing you go to see is, what was it?
The British Grand Prix.
So is that like, this is Formula One racing.
Formula One
so
racing.
Open wheel racing.
Open wheel racing.
Americans would think of Indy cars, but this is a little bit different type of car.
You turn left, but you also have to turn right
as well.
Which is very different.
Sometimes through town, sometimes on track. Well, not like partly.
There are one or two road courses, but it's mostly set tracks. Yeah. The British Grand Prix is one of the oldest races on the calendar. It's at a circuit called Silverstone.
Where's that, roughly?
It's about an hour and a half out of London.
Okay.
Very easy to get to. Here's one thing that I also found was interesting. The Tour de France is completely free. Okay? It's a sporting event. It's free. Yep.
You're shot
by the road.
Okay.
And if you want to go to the
start. I can see that at parts, but like the starting stuff?
There are certain things that if you are a sponsor, you can get extra access
little boost.
But in general, like the sponsor's caravan, you can just stand there and collect stuff. Mm-hmm. People around me were just collecting stuff. I ended up eating a 1-inch chunk of dried sausage that was thrown out in a plastic thing.
At least it was
in
a plastic thing. If you had told me if it was thrown out as it was, landed on the pavement, you said, 5-second rule.
I would have gone, hey, it's France. That's how we do it here. Decided to go to the practice day. Not even qualifying, but the practice day. So this is 2 days before the Grand Prix. £10. So the equivalent of $15. Well, I don't know what it is now. Probably about $3 now. Yeah. Because I'm one of those people, I like motor racing, but I couldn't sit in a stand and watch a race because all I'm seeing is people go by. Even if they're going by 70 times, they're going by and I don't really know what's going on. But going to practice, I'm not so much hung up about what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm just enjoying seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to Silverstone. The crowd for practice was 45,000 people around a 3-mile circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, on the practice day, you can sit up in
the
grandstands.
Like when they have a race?
I think when they have a race, you can get, in the grandstands alone, you can get 70,000 people.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so
and then there are people scattered around the track. So there was a lot of people, but we just walked around the track. We sat in the grandstands. You watched the cars go by. Play a clip. This is what 6 Formula One cars sounds like bombing by during the practice session. And they're just out testing their cars. They're just trying to see what they can do.
Along with some wind.
Yes. And I'm standing about 30 yards.
Automotively induced wind.
Yeah.
It's in stereo, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody will be able to tell that because we podcast in mono.
We podcast in mono, but
maybe you should put this one out in stereo, though I think it makes it a lot bigger file.
Yeah.
That's the next.
Just play another one while we'll talk.
This is two cars, so this won't be two.
And the cars are just out there practicing. They're testing. They're setting up the car properly.
They're very buzzy.
It's
not like NASCAR.
No, because the cars are all turbo engines, so it's sort of this whine of a turbo. Apparently, it's not as loud as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Since they put turbos in the cars, it's made the cars quieter. It's kind of neat to be there. You're just seeing these cars go zooming by at high speed. You're seeing a Ferrari and McLaren and Mercedes and all these famous names from Formula One motorsport. Someone had said to me, make sure you take earplugs. At first, I thought, I'm not going to need earplugs. by the afternoon session, I'm looking in my pocket for the earplugs. I'm like, oh, I'm putting them in, because it just gets.
Yeah, we've talked about NASCAR before, and that's, you definitely want to have earplugs or headsets on most races. Although, see, but the thing is, like at NASCAR, you can see the whole track. Although short tracks, the problem is then everybody's overlapping each other. You really can't tell who's in first either. But this is one, you know, they've talked about how the TV has really helped the sport out because it's easier to watch this stuff on TV than it is live.
You know,
when you're live, I guess the thing is that when you're live, you're seeing all the little bits and pieces that you're never going to see on TV. But if you really are just there to see who wins and who passes whom, it's going to be better on TV.
The Formula One on the Friday before a Sunday race, they have an hour and a half session in the morning and an hour and a half session in the afternoon. In the morning, where I got most of these clips, we were walking parts of the course. Mm-hmm. And at Silverstone, it's basically just like sort of concrete steps, and you can just stand and grab your beer and watch the cars go by, and everyone's taking photos. Then for the afternoon session, we sat up in the grandstand opposite pit row.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the equivalent of being on like the upper deck at a baseball game. And it was kind of neat being opposite pit row. To your point, you can see what's going on. You can see when a car pulls in, what they do to it. You can see all the people milling around. And while there's no, you know, on TV, you're knowing exactly what's going on. It was nice to sit 30 yards away and now get a greater appreciation for, oh, wow, when the car pulls in, it really is 14 guys surrounding this tiny little car. When I watch it now on TV, I think I haven't seen it in the flesh. I'm now going to have a greater appreciation for all the bits and bobs that go around it. But if someone said to me, would you want to watch a race this way? Maybe one time to say I've done that experience. Sure. But in general,
you're not going to be one of these folks with a camper going to follow from place to place.
Even if I was like a super celebrity millionaire with money to burn, if someone said, oh, do you want to get the private jet and go to the German Grand Prix? I'm going to go, I'm just going to watch it on TV.
Because
then I can really know what's going on. Yep. So like the Tour, it's another event that you kind of experience, but in terms of watching the event, like for example, I've seen soccer teams and basketball teams, either college or professional or international teams, I've seen them practice. And while that's interesting, at the end of the day, I want to see the game.
Sure.
And I'm more than happy to go and see the game in the flesh because that's the experience. I'm more than happy to watch Formula One practice. But when it comes to actually seeing the game, I'm going to watch it on TV.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say about that is, I'm trying to think, I saw some practices of NASCAR and going to the event itself, you know, like it takes everything to a new level. Like all those little things that you could see at practice, you could see those at a race, and it's a bigger deal. But it's still in terms of like, if you're watching to see who's winning and things like that, you're more likely to.
The noise is the coolest thing. And like I said, my clips don't do it justice. Even the new Formula One engines with the turbo. You're standing there for an hour and a half.
You gotta wear like glasses because the debris kicks up and gets in your eyes.
I did see one what they call shunt. Guy came around the bend and a couple of cars, the cars were all taking this last bend at Silverstone before home straight. It's quite a tight, you know, almost a 90 degree turn. And they're all, you can see the cars kind of slide around the corner as each driver is trying to figure out how fast can I take this turn
without losing traction
and then speeding up on the long home straight. I didn't have the microphone running. One guy came around and overcooked it, and you saw him completely spin around and hit the barriers, and it went clump, and everyone in the stands is going, whoa.
Just solo, not with another car.
Yeah, just solo. Wasn't it race speed? But that was kind of cool, too. Cool. It was kind of neat to see that.
Sure, no, you want to know. It keeps it more serious as to what it is.
And then, of course, the 5,000 of you sitting in that stand, you then spend the next 15 minutes hoping each car is going to wipe out as it comes around the corner. I'm very honest about it.
It's exciting that way.
So, yeah, I did enjoy it as an experience. I really enjoyed it as the noise. My only disappointment was that even on the practice day, I was under the assumption that it was going to be more open times where the crowd could get either near the cars.
Out in the pits and stuff.
The drivers. That's only for the top corporate people. Before the second practice session started, there were all kinds of, there must have been about 400 to 500 very well-dressed people walking up and down pit lane. And I'm thinking, yeah, they're the guys who get to get that close.
Yeah, you know, I had a pit pass once for a NASCAR race at Richmond. And I think it only extended for pre-race time. Like if so you could go poke around there and it was, hey, look at the big tires. But nobody was really doing a lot at that time. So it wasn't terribly exciting.
So anyway, so that was Formula One.
All right. All outdoor sports. So our last sporting outing was
the Open at Troon. Two practice days at the Open. Which, I do want to circle back to
the British
notion
person
of
says the Open.
Practice.
By the way, that means the British.
The
Open.
British Open.
Yeah, yes.
The We had practice sessions for Sunday and Monday. I might as well say it now. Someone, the cynic out there can say, Zeph, you said you went to all these things, but you didn't. You only went to practice. I'm going to tell you something right now. For these events, I would tell anyone, don't waste your time going. Go to practice.
Well, I don't.
No, because I think also I got all kinds of.
I think the right answer is it's not bad. The practice is worth going to. But like, do you want to go to the event?
That's a good way of putting it. It's really worth. Practice isn't something, especially for golf. The rules at the Open is during the practice rounds, you can take photos and snap away. The stars.
Do they play like a full round, or do they go like, I've done 12 holes, I'm done?
Some of them do. Some of them go from hole to hole. We got up close to Justin Rose, who said to me and my buddy, all right, lads. And we said, good luck this week. And then he wandered off.
He just happened to be made eye contact with you.
We were one of four people following him on Sunday in a 50-degree day with driving rain off the Irish Sea. I think he appreciated the fact that we walked with him for six holes. I was pleasantly surprised, and I want to take this back briefly to the Tour de France. I was pleasantly surprised at how accessible the stars were. I saw Dustin Johnson, who just won the U.S. Open, Jason Day, the number one player in the world, Ernie Els, who's still a great golfer, but he won all his stuff about 10 years ago, the aforementioned Justin Rose. Anytime on the Sunday and the Monday when they were sort of crossing from hole to hole or whatever, kid or an adult, if they went up to them to sign something, they would stop and sign, take selfies. They were very, very accessible.
Selfies.
I was actually really impressed with that. Back at the Tour de France, 2 days before the race began, they had a presentation in one of the host towns. And what it was a whole night where each team is brought up on stage, the star is interviewed, there's music. And then on their way back to their
press day at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, on their way back to their team coach. The people get on their bikes and they ride around this small village and then go back to their coach. I was pleasantly surprised at how, as each team rode around, three or four members of each team, and in the Tour, a cycling team has nine guys on it, some of them would ride up next to the barriers with their arm out, just high-fiving. And I think we're in this era where there's always stories about NFL players and Premier League players. You know, when you watch on TV, they're showing up with their headphones on and being very gruff with reporters. I was pleasantly surprised at both the Tour and at the Open at how accessible the players were. Mm-hmm. I kind of think that's important. So we can actually now – you can now listen.
Yeah, this will be some quality audio.
Yeah.
Which one did you have a pick here?
Start playing Open Day Drive, I think. So this is now sometime in the next couple of minutes, you're going to hear a click. Yeah. This is the sound
of wind noises.
This is the sound of
course, it is Scotland, so it's always wind noises.
This is the sound of the number one player in the world. There he is. That's the number one player in the world. He's just hit his ball.
Should we go back there?
If you missed that, here we go again. Golf on the radio. There you go. That's what it sounds like. Go ahead and play Open Rose. This is Justin Rose, a British player, English player, won the US Open a couple of years ago. You now know what you're listening for.
Yeah.
This is what it sounds like when he hits the ball.
Is that it, right?
I don't know. So windy. There you go. That's Justin Rose hitting the ball. So, oh, look. They
golf
sound
on
so
the radio. That's going to be our new band name.
Play them, golf on the radio. Play, just start the range. One of the nice things about a golf course, if you're a golfer, is at these tournaments, you can go and sit on the range where they warm up and where they practice.
That I remember doing. You hear lots of those,
but it's interesting. I was struck. You can sit and watch your stars hit balls. You know your favorite player. I was also shocked on the range at the British Open. They have room for about 30 golfers at once, but there's about 150 people on the range. All kinds of other people hanging out behind. Swing gurus, caddies, guys who clearly work for the manufacturing firms. A lot of people milling around. It's interesting to see. You know, some pros are there. They have a little camera behind them, or they've brought iPads and computers.
It's quite.
You know, this notion that people that don't play golf think it's just a bunch of dudes who show up on a Saturday and hit it around. No, that's what my partner and I do when we play golf.
Yeah.
The pros, this is serious business. So, yeah, it was interesting. One thing I will say about Scotland, like France, it's cold and wet. I don't know what it is with these countries, but it's cold and wet. I know that. So, yeah, that was it. You can stop that now, because I could probably hear someone behind me going, look, there's a Rory.
I thought there was one clip when we were checking beforehand and we heard a baby crying at the beginning, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I think that's someone else hitting the ball.
That's right. I don't think that's
But let me tell you something. Someone else hitting the ball sounds just like those other dudes hitting the ball. I was surprised. When you walk one of these, it is interesting, though, to come back, and we're recording on open weekend. It is interesting, once you've walked one of these courses to then watch it on TV, you do have a different sense of distance. You do have a different sense of the wind conditions. It's definitely an experience to go to one of these things. If you're even semi, if it's something where it's a sport where you might watch it when the big ones are on. If someone said to me, oh, I can get you practice round tickets for your local tour event. If you've not done it, and you have any interest in watching golf on TV, I would probably suggest to you to do it. Just because when you end up watching the event, I think you do have a greater appreciation for what the pros do. And even if you're someone who plays golf, I always think it's good. I find it fascinating, you know, standing, because again, golf's a sport, unlike soccer or NFL or basketball. You know, on these practice rounds, you're 5 yards away from them. So you can see everything that they do. So if you're interested in the sport, you're really learning about.
Well, and it's pretty easy. Like, as long as you're not going to super big events, you know, the PGA Tour itself goes around to enough places. And so you can see the stars. It might not be the biggest event of the year.
No, but you can get up close.
See locally, and you walk. And I always found, you know, I would go to the Kemper Open when it was here. All the Now it's, I guess, really replaced on the schedule with Tiger Woods thing. But you could do either. You could stay in one hole and see how a series of golfers play up to the same hole or tee off from the same hole or things like that. Or you could follow a couple people around and see, you know, how they do around. It's definitely interesting if you have even just a remote sort of curiosity about golf.
Yeah, like I say, I think with both that and the tour, the biggest things that struck me was how the sense of there is a closeness between the players and their fans. And I do think with a lot of a lot of big time sports that we all tend to watch on TV, there definitely seems there's a different sort of distance between yourself and your favorite quarterback or yourself and your favorite center forward. Whereas, you know, at the tour, yeah, they'll give you a high five. At golf, if you're on the practice round, yeah, they'll stop and take a selfie with you. You know, and it's weird being of indeterminate middle age. Yeah. Justin Rose came and said hello to us.
Yeah,
but there you go. That's kind of cool. And you know, like I say, it's an interesting. It was interesting going to some events where your perspective of the actual event and your perspective of the competitors is now slightly different than maybe some other traditional, or especially sports that are arena based.
Yeah. Much more remote. I mean, all these sports were, like, so I didn't even think about it until we started doing it, that all these things you went to, I mean, even the Wimbledon to some extent, which you didn't go to, but it was an opportunity for those rounds to just wander around. It was part of the festival. It's part of an involvement in it. Kind of, I don't think you'd have as much contact with athletes.
My friends did say to me, and I want to give them a shout out. I want to give a shout out to
Spike Guest.
Spike Guest Cameron, who's been on this show and was never invited back. And also Ed from Detroit, who I traveled with. I both asked them about Wimbledon, and they both said, yeah, sitting at court one was great. But they also spent some time on one of those outer courts.
Yeah.
They said that it was just as much fun being on court 15, where there's only two rows of seats.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they were seeing any major star.
Yeah, but they're all a lot better than any of us.
There's still people who are playing for a living, and you're right there. And so there is something about these sports. The attraction, I think, to people is their accessibility. And like I say, you know, with the tour, yeah, you're right there with them, and that was kind of cool.
Breaking news, you know, this will be big for people. As we speak, it looks like Stenson is up by 2 through 15 on Mickelson.
There you go.
So this will be very timely news when this podcast comes out in 2 days.
But I'm going to tell you guys who did or did not know that, when you listen to them hit the ball, it sounds just like people you
met. That's right.
I tried to actually get a shot. I tried to get a clip of just Dustin Johnson, he's one of these guys who hits it 340 yards.
Mm-hmm.
He was teeing off at one hole, but at Royal Troon, as it's known, he was teeing off at the hole right next to the railroad line. And a train went by, and I'm like, well, so much for that. Yeah. And, of course, now he's hit it. You can't go, oh, do it again, do it again. And I'm like, I'm waiting for some no-name.
If you had those little foam things on the microphone, maybe it would work.
I should have been better prepared, yes. Yeah. That's the interesting thing. Security for the British Open was, it's a bit like going to the airport. When you get off the bus, but when you park your car in a field, you then have to get on a shuttle bus. So going
a lot of places are like that, even if it's not the biggest events, just because it's hard to access. It's not like golf courses have parking lots that accommodate that many people.
Well, to come back to your point you made about the Tour de France and the fans, you can't control those crowds.
No.
And in light of some of the things that have happened, and I don't want to end the show on a downer, it's interesting. Like I say, when we went to Formula One, you just walked through, you turned in your ticket, and you walked onto the property. Yeah. So I just find it interesting. But again, yeah, there was a real sort of accessibility.
All right. Sports in Europe. I guess I would call that podcast.
Yes, and of course.
And Zeph coughing.
I can only hope that when Brexit occurs, that we're now not locked out of all these great European sports.
They did say, your manager, Arsene Wenger, says it's going to have a major impact on the Premier League. Not so much because, it could have labor. The labor rules could be a little bit different, but also just thinks the financial backing behind these, the sponsors and things like that, to the extent it shifts away from being
to finish where
British
we started.
Centric.
If I'd been in charge of the Remain campaign, I would have just gone to everyone and said, do you want your favorite football team to now suck? Because when all the foreign players are gone, we're going to be stuck with our English players. And of course, I was also home to watch England crash out of the European Championships.
Oh, that's right. You know, because I was thinking to myself, but you weren't in France during the Euros. The Euros were
over. Well, we were.
Oh,
we
so
were.
You didn't go to any of those.
We'd originally
that'd be a hard ticket to get.
We'd originally tried to get tickets. That was sort of how this trip had started, was around that. And of course, that was the one thing we couldn't get tickets for.
Yeah, but the British crash, the English crash out against Iceland was very close in time, like a couple days before Brexit, I think.
No, it was after Brexit. After, yeah. Yeah. And of course, insult to injury.
Cue
numerous Brexit jokes, which the morning after aren't very funny at all.
Yeah. They're funny when you say it to your friend, like at the time of the game, when they've like been 20 more times by the next morning.
There's one satirical magazine in England, called Private Eye, and it's July cover. I don't know what the American equivalent is. It's sort of a mix of The Onion, but also some sort of relatively hard hitting political opinion.
Yeah. I don't think we have a corollary.
They had a cover of a stock photo of the England team getting off an airplane, and it said a Brexit announcement, and then they'd put like a little bubble next to one of the players, and it said, "We'll be out of Europe before you know it," and that was quite funny. There you go. Yeah. So shout out to Private Eye.
All right.
So yeah, that was summer sport, and then I guess we have one more event to go for our big summer.
Somebody has an event.
Yeah,
I'm not overselling this because I'm not quite sure how it's going to work out. But.
Yeah, because I'm getting married shortly, so again, it's not too late to send cash or a gift or anything like that. Just send it care of the show, AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. Just say, look, I pledge $50, and then we will follow up with you to get the money from you.
If we had a PayPal account for AtlanticVoice@gmail.com, we could just have them send it directly to the email.
Yeah, we could do that. That's another event that we will be covering. And I must say, after the big sports trip, it's a bit of an anticlimax.
It's not very nice.
I think that's it for this week, right?
Anything else?
This has been The Atlantic Voice. I'm Zeph.
I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on The Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.